This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip C. and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. On today's Breakfast Grill, we are in conversation with Dr. Edward Harcourt. He's the Senior Vice President and Managing Director for Enrollment Solutions at QS, short for Quaccarelli Simmons, as we understand how the world's leading provider of services, analytics and insight is shaping the global higher education sector. Your mission is, quote, to enable motivated people anywhere in the world to fulfill their potential through educational achievement, international mobility and career development. Do you think the pandemic is testing and derailing that mission?
Well, thank you for starting with the mission. We are a mission-led organization. We are a commercial organization. We've been around for 30 years, but our founder, Nunzio Quaccarelli, articulated that mission 30 years ago, and that's guided the development of the company over the past three decades. Yes, I think despite the challenging times that we've all been living through and the frustration that many internationally mobile students have experienced, not being able to cross borders, not being able to take up their offers of study at international institutions, we do believe that the outlook for international higher education remains very strong. There's continued growth in the capacity of the sector, and there's continued growth in the number of young people all around the world who are determined to make the best of the opportunity that they've earned to study at some of the top universities.
When you unpack the word international higher education, honestly, that's really been turned over its head, isn't it? Because we see globalization being sorely tested. We've actually also witnessed the scandals at admissions tests happening in the United States. Borders are entirely shut. People are actually doing a fundamental rethink of education and focusing on specific skills. It is the time now for higher education to fundamentally reset, isn't it?
A number of politicians have made that point in a number of national contexts. And of course, the notion of an international higher education sector is a little bit of a construct. It's a bit like the international community. I mean, there's a community of nation states who collaborate internationally. And it's not that different really with universities. Universities are creatures of nation states. They are located in very specific places. They're largely funded by national governments. But I would say, Phil, that actually collaboration between universities has actually strengthened during the pandemic. And the sector or universities worldwide, particularly those that were used to receiving large numbers of internationally mobile students, have actually transformed quite remarkably by putting a lot of their content online. They've been able to reach students who otherwise wouldn't have been able to have traveled and to take up. They wouldn't have the resources to travel or might be uncomfortable leaving their country of origin to study in Australia or in the United Kingdom or the United States, the three major destinations for international students. The availability of online study, I think, has to some degree democratized access to higher education. We've been regularly surveying international applicants throughout the course of the pandemic on their sentiments and their view on the COVID restrictions and vaccination and everything else and in between. And actually, most applicants have remained determined and resolute in their ambition to achieve their goal, reach their destination. And only 5% have said that they're now reconsidering their previous ambition to study outside their country.
And I wonder, you say digital has democratized education, it's made it available. It is really out of necessity, isn't it? This is inevitable and everyone had to do it.
Yes, everybody had to do it. I mean, there's been talk in universities about moving online and digitizing content for years. This was the crisis that forced everyone's hand. But it did surprise many of us just how quickly, there was no choice, as you say, it was first force of circumstance, but it was quite a dramatic transformation that universities pulled off. And I think that will be a permanent shift. Well, undoubtedly, most students will want to go back to in-presence study and study on campus. I don't think the digitization of the content is going to be put on the shelf to gather dust. I think that will continue to be part now of a more hybrid learning environment than we had before the pandemic.
I'm quite keen to understand what this means actually for the universities and how they're ranked and rated, because, you know, your rankings, the QS ratings, literally they are considered the Bible of, you know, what is considered a high performance of very good university. It is a very heavy burden and it also puts a lot of pressure. And sometimes I feel the success and failure of a university very much hangs on where you sit on that ranking. Do you think it's playing an outsized importance of rankings and ratings?
Look, I think rankings need to be put in context. They're a useful comparative tool for people managing institutions where they can benchmark their performance against their peers and other universities that they directly compare themselves to. And it's a very useful consumer guide for parents and students and others who are advising young people on where to study. It's a big world out there. I mean, we rank thousands of universities. Yeah. The choice is almost limitless. And this is a big investment decision that families are making. And we think that the US rankings have really given consumers a guide to excellence, a guide to choice.
Yeah, and I get the point that you want to streamline it and kind of create a level playing field in how you assess it, because you believe that actually education should have a common standard across the globe. But I'm worried that actually people are abusing it, isn't it? People are placing overimportance. And it's not only students, it's the parents, it's also the universities, also employers. You know, and that's a big risk, isn't it? That people tend to abuse these rankings.
Well, I think most people who use the rankings do, I think, use the data in context, and they do use other sources of information. I mean, I would always advise a student to reach out and communicate with their intended university destination directly, to have that authentic touch point. I mean, nobody should be taking a decision on where to study based solely on the rankings. And I think very, very few people would do that. But undeniably, they have become a significant shaper of opinion, both within and without universities. You've got university senior managers now who set their strategic goals, and often a KPI is their position in the rankings.
I know. And what's even worse is we actually see examples in Malaysia of businesses. If you don't have a degree from Cambridge, from Oxford, from Harvard, MIT, you won't even look at it. Or if it is there, they immediately get fast-tracked. And that's employers especially tend to use this out of context. You know, I know you are encouraging people to use it in context, but many employers here use it out of context. And because of that, it puts a lot of pressure on the students. It puts lots of pressure on the parents.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are examples of that, Phil. But again, I think most people would use them, you know, discerningly, and you know, look at them very much in context. My own view of the university sector in many countries around the world is that there's real excellence in depth, and there's enormous development potential, particularly in Asian countries now, to produce really outstanding universities. There are many outstanding universities in Asia already. What the rankings have done is to put a lot more universities on the map. Everyone knows of Oxford and Cambridge. Mm. Everyone knows of Harvard and Yale. And a handful of others have got that global market brand penetration. But if I was an employer, I'd also be wanting to look at, you know, the up-and-coming universities, the universities that are really giving students the skills to adapt to the workplace in the 21st century. You know, soft skills, employers tell us, are just as important as knowledge in many of the graduates that they hire. And they want a student who's had a rounded educational experience and not just someone who studied perhaps at a very well-known institution. Yeah, so I think the rankings have helped to level the playing field and bring a lot more universities into the limelight and to demonstrate to employers that there is real strength and depth in the university sector.
So then help me understand this. If I look at the criteria of how you conduct the rankings, you have six criteria. Yep. 40% is academic reputation, with 20% faculty-student ratio, 20% citation by faculty. I want to emphasize on this academic reputation, that 40% weighting is the highest weighting. Doesn't that perpetuate this cycle then of the higher performing universities or the reputable ones just reinforced again? So it makes it harder for up-and-coming universities to do well because of the nature of the weighting and rankings of the survey?
Well, I think academic reputation is a very difficult thing to...
Yeah, it's qualitative to a certain extent, isn't
it?
Yeah.
Any academic department has got a range of, you know, outputs from individual academics. There are academic fields where there's very strong collaboration and research is team-led, but many academic fields are individually led. So ranking and assessing the performance of individual academics is a very, very difficult thing. I mean, in my country, the United Kingdom, there's been a whole government-led research assessment exercise framework to try and understand and rate. It's a little bit crude the way that it's come out. But what we do is to ask academics all around the world, and anyone with an academic position can, you know, sign up and tell us which university departments in their field they're most impressed by. Where is the research coming out of universities that is shaping their field, going on to their graduate curriculum? Yeah, where are the colleagues that they collaborate with and most admire? And yes, there is a risk there of those
bias.
groups of academics who maybe got to know each other in graduate school at a top-ranked university who then get dispersed across the university sector who continue to like each other's work. Yeah, there is a danger with that. But I think it also enables, again, an outstanding academic performer in a department at the university that you haven't heard of to get named in a top 10 university department rankings by academic peer. It would be very difficult for them to achieve that level of visibility.
Sure, but because of your breadth and depth of your academic network, it is going to really see shifts at a glacial pace, isn't it? Because it's such a large network, just having one or two outstanding academic researchers in a university won't cut it, isn't it? You need the institutional changes. So I wonder whether QS university rankings then reflect the transformative action required to take place in universities.
We do see actually quite a lot of change in the rankings. I mean, for the first time in 2022, two mainland Chinese universities, Tsinghua and Beida, got in the global top 20. That's a landmark achievement for Chinese higher education. We saw Malaysian universities, 60% improved their performance in the last Asia ranking. Japan, by contrast, 48% of universities in Japan went down in the rankings. So we do see, yes, the top 10 is a little bit set and there has been a few changes in the top 10 maybe over the last 10 years. But I think, I mean, I went to the University of Warwick, which is a very well-known, highly regarded university. It's in my hometown in Coventry. I was born the same year that the University of Warwick was founded. And in 50 years, it's a global top 100 university. So I do think, change does happen. I wouldn't say it's glacial pace, but there's no doubt that the ancients have a bit of a head start in terms of establishing reputation, building capacity, attracting the top talent.
You talk about the ancients, and it's true. If you look at the top 10, and I was just analyzing it 10 years ago, 2011 versus 2021, not really much has changed. It's the same old suspects, isn't it? MIT, Cambridge, Oxford, Harvard, Yale, Imperial College, they're all there the same. I think you're right to say that from 11 to 20, you see that shifts taking place. Yeah. And you see the likes of Singapore, Nanyang, and US also rising up, and even University of Malaysia also made great progress. But honestly, those ancients, the top 10, it's sticky, isn't it? They're not going to shift in the next few years.
Well, I wouldn't bet on that, actually, Phil. I think you mentioned the University of Malaya now ranked 64th in the global university rankings, one of the top universities in Asia. I mean, a great pedigree, great history. The University of Malaya has got every opportunity, I think, to develop its position. It's got a very strong research base. It's highly respected around the world. Yeah, there are steps it can take to improve its position in terms of its research environment, the resources dedicated to teaching. You've got to look at the placement of your graduates with employees and so on. You've got to look at internationalization metrics because, 10% of the criteria, as you said, was on the proportion of your academic staff and your student body that comes outside of the country. Yeah, so there are steps institutions can take, but I think the University of Malaya is in a pretty good position.
On the Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Dr. Edward Harcourt, Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Enrollment Solutions at Quaker Raleigh Simmons QS. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. On the Breakfast Grill, we have Dr. Edward Harcourt. He's the Senior Vice President and MD of Enrollment Solutions at Quaker Raleigh Simmons. He's in a hot seat as we go through the issues facing the global higher education sector. Now, Dr. Harcourt, in the earlier segment, we talked about rankings. So break down your business for us, because you offer solutions, services, conferences, analytics. Break down the revenue streams of QS and how has it evolved in the past 3 to 4 years?
Our revenue has remained strong over the last 2 years. Turnover is just over about 40 million sterling globally. And while we've not been able to achieve the revenue growth that we'd projected in 2020 and 2021, we nonetheless have been able to grow a little bit. And
what were your expectations prior to the pandemic?
Well, QS is one of the most recognizable and trusted brands in the international higher education arena. And we've been around for 30 years. And we think we've got a tremendous opportunity to really scale up now and grow the revenues of the company, 2 or 3 times over the next 3 to 5 years. That was the plan that we had set back in 2019, and that's still the trajectory that we feel that we're on. The international higher education sector is continuing to grow. We have a diversified set of products and services, as you alluded to. We run a lot of recruitment-related activities, from fairs and events all the way through to partnering with universities to convert students and enroll them on campuses, though Most students have enrolled online in the last 2 years. But we've got a very diversified revenue source as well across many higher education economies. And that has also enabled us to be quite resilient as we've absorbed some impacts, particularly from the events business, which has obviously had an impact from the pandemic. But other parts of the portfolio in other parts of the world have performed better than expected.
So I wonder, what do universities ask your help for now? How has that changed since the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think universities have stayed close to us, and what they're looking for, I think, are insights into what students are thinking, in particular what student applicants are thinking. One of the initiatives that we developed back at the start of the pandemic was to run a global pulse survey every 2 weeks of international applicants. And we were able to keep our finger on the pulse of their sentiments and their intentions as borders closed and a lot of academic study went online. And what we were able to reassure our university clients about was that students remained committed to their goal of reaching the destination ultimately. They were prepared to study online for a year or more, but they wanted to see that pathway through to getting on campus eventually. And that's now starting to happen in Australia, for example, where the borders opened just before the end of last year. So students who'd spent 2021 studying online will now be able to travel to Australia and commence their study in presence.
So the destination hasn't changed, but presumably the pathway, the journey to get there, has evolved significantly post-pandemic. What are those shifts that are likely to stay permanent as a result of this pandemic?
Well, I think we are likely to see more hybridity now in the learning context. I think students will still prefer to be resident in their place of study. But we have seen the emergence of new communities of learners who are now able to access higher education in a way that they possibly couldn't previously, because they can study online from home, and that dramatically reduces the cost of obtaining a higher education qualification. So I think we have enlarged the market. The market for higher education has enlarged in some ways on the back of the pandemic. But our pulse surveys reveal that about a quarter of students were prepared to study their degree fully online, and three quarters really wanted to have that experience of being on the campus, experience of traveling internationally. And, you know, I mean, look, this is the biggest decision that they and their families are likely to make, bigger than a house purchase. And they want to have the full experience.
And the question, though, still remains that the operating models for many of these universities will have to be re-examined. Is it going to be the case where we're going to see a larger pool, lower fees, a smaller campus? Is that a future operating model for universities?
It's a bit too soon to say definitively, I think, whether we're going to see universities reduce in size. At the moment, I don't think that is happening. I think what they're doing is expanding to accommodate the numbers of students who are continuing to study online. What is clearly happening, though, is that the ability of universities to invest in their estates, to invest in their professional services, to invest in their student services has been constrained by the pandemic. I mean, if you look at Australia in particular, where there was a very high exposure to international student tuition fees, some Australian universities take a third or more of their revenue from international students. So there has been a revenue shock, and I think that has constrained their ability to invest. And that's, again, something that we've been able to partner with them on, because we have a shared services partnership model where we can work as an extension of the university recruitment and enrollment team. And that's something that a number of universities in Australia and the UK have taken advantage of.
I can imagine, especially for many universities that have an over-reliance on international students, they probably need to see the analytics to decide how do they make those fundamental shifts. So I get the value add that you provide for universities who have to make these huge investment decisions. But we also should then shift to students, because you've also acquired Student Apply, which is this edtech platform, right, where you allow students to receive personalized counseling. Give us a bit of depth about this application or this purchase that you made. What does it mean? How do you expect it to contribute to the revenue? What is the process in which you plan to use the product here to integrate with all the other solutions you offer?
Yes, we acquired Student Apply, an edtech startup, just at the back end of last year. And the reason we did that, Phil, is that we're trying to pull together all of our student recruitment related services, from top of the funnel talent attraction of our digital assets, top universities Business.com, the fairs and events that we produce, we've got some very considerable talent attraction assets. And then we've got a very strong enrollment solutions business that can partner with universities to convert student interest into enrollment. What was missing, if you like, was that middle piece about the market engagement with the agent network all around the world. I mean, Student Apply is not an agency. It's not a student recruitment agency. But what they do is they are able to qualify highly suitable leads for particular institutional clients. And they only really submit applications into universities from students who they know are highly motivated and are qualified to gain admission onto their intended course of study. And that for QS will mean in time, it's going to take us time now to absorb Student Apply and integrate their capabilities into this broader end-to-end service proposition. But that, what that will enable us to do is to provide more of an end-to-end strategic partnership model for university clients.
Do you think there is this conflict sometimes when you're serving both students and universities, when you start integrating all this and offer end-to-end solutions?
I don't think so, because it does come back to our mission again. I mean, I've spent my career working in the university sector. I was a Pro Vice Chancellor at a university in the UK. I've been a Director of International. This is my first job in the commercial sector, if you like. And it was a very easy transition for me because the mission of QS is very aligned to the mission of universities. Yes, we are trying to create value, but we're still owned by our founder. We're not having to keep, you know, a whole party of shareholders happy at the end of each year. We take a long-term sort of investment approach to the work that we do. And it is about really supporting the development of capacity within the higher education sector globally, enabling motivated people around the world to get on and achieve their potential. And I think those two purposes are in pretty close alignment and match really what universities are about.
And I guess that gap in professional development, in capacity development, is most stark in developing countries, especially in Asia. So, you know, give us a sense of how big Asia is to the business, because QS has quite an extensive operation in Asia.
Well, I think the future of higher education is going to have very strong Asian characteristics and with lots of very strong Asian institutions. You know, the amount of investment that's going into higher education across a number of Asian countries in the last 10, 15, 20 years is only going to grow. As we were saying earlier, you know, China is now the largest higher education economy in the world. We've actually only just this last year launched our Chinese language website and appointed staff domiciled in mainland China. So that perhaps gives you an indication of, yes, we've been very strong in our presence in Southeast Asia. We've got, you know, offices in KL and also in Singapore. We've run the QS Apple Asia Conference now for over 15 years. That's been a venue for thought leadership in the development of higher education in Asia. We work with universities across a number of Asian economies, but not until recently have we really set our stall out in China, and it's at the very early stages of us doing that. So, yeah, lots of growth potential for us.
But China does present many challenges. We have seen that crackdown on education institutions, on tech education, isn't it? Are you worried about that?
Well, it's really manifested itself as a concern for us, I think, in Hong Kong principally, because you've got a number of very, very strong universities in Hong Kong who are now starting to feel a bit of a chill from the influence of Chinese national politics, as you alluded to, and that does concern us. But look, I think the way to support Chinese academics and Chinese higher education institutions is to foster partnership and engagement with peers around the world. I mean, that is the beauty of the international higher education arena. I mean, yes, we are subject to local laws and to state funding, and we are creatures of nation states, as I was saying earlier. But there is a genuine international community element to a lot of the work that academic staff do. If you take a typical academic, they may well have studied in their own country for their first degree. They then went abroad for their graduate education. They may have got their first job in a third international location, married somebody from another country, and then ended up working elsewhere or maybe going home. I mean, these are the international citizens of the 21st century, and keeping that community in conversation with itself and, you know, strengthening the ability of that community to broadcast its research, to engage young minds, to educate the people of the future, I think that's our best response to the behaviour of states, not just in China. I mean, we've seen some pretty restrictive policies in Australia over the last year. And yeah, the UK and the United States is not immune to meddling in the freedoms of the higher education sector. But there is a particular concern about Graham Charlotte. Will a freedom of inquiry be tolerated? That is a very serious question. And I think that's one that, you know, China's going to have to figure out for itself. But what we can help to do is make sure that Chinese academics, Chinese students remain in conversation with the rest of the world.
On the Breakfast Grill, Dr. Edward Harkert, Senior Vice President and MD of Enrollment Solutions at Quaccarelli Simmons QS. I'm Philip C, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.